Okay, I'd like to call the House Resources Committee to order. We are located in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Representative Sadler, Representative Mears, Representative Dibert, Representative McCabe, and myself, Chairman Tom McKay. We do have a quorum to conduct business. And I would like to thank the staff, Justin and Zach, and committee aide Ed King. And we are joined by Representative Rauscher. I'd remind everyone to please silence your cell phones and all your other electronic devices so we don't have any undesirable interruptions. So today, we have three items on the agenda. First, we will interview the last appointee assigned to this committee for confirmation for the, I believe it's the Board of Game. Then we will hear a presentation from ADA that was previously scheduled. Finally, we will get an introduction to House Bill 20 by Representative Stutes. So we begin with a consideration of appointees. Our first item is the consideration of Mr. Stanley Hoffman to the State Board of Game. Mr. Hoffman, can you hear me okay?
Yes, Mr. Chair McKay, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. You might speak up a little bit.
Okay, how about now?
Yeah, that's quite a bit better. Thank you very much. So, Mr. Hoffman, please state your name and your affiliation for the record.
Yeah, for the record, Mr. Chair, Chairman McKay, my name is Stanley Hoffman. I'm from Bethel, Alaska.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Do you have any prepared remarks?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair.
Okay, please proceed.
Good afternoon, House Chairman McKay and members of the House Resources Committee. It's an honor to be here before you today. For the record, my name is Stanley L. Hoffman, Jr. Everyone calls me Stosh. I'm a lifelong Alaskan born in Bethel, and I grew up in McGrath and currently reside in Bethel, where I've lived for the last 30 years with my wife. My wife and I have raised our two sons and our nephew. We enjoyed the subsistence lifestyle and all that it has to offer. I am a former assistant guide. All my guide activity took place in Unit 19B Bravo. My assistant guide license expired in 2017. I was an assistant guide for about 20 years. I am also a commercial fisherman in waiting. Commercial fishing has been closed on the Lower Kuskokwim since about 2007. I've held the Lower Kuskokwim, Kuskokwim Bay limited entry permit since the late 1980s. It is my hope that commercial fishing returns again someday to the Lower Kuskokwim River. I was appointed to the Board of Game by Governor Palin in 2008, and I have been reappointed by every governor since then to continue my service on the Board of Game. I also have chaired the Board of Game in the past. Alaska has the best public wildlife management process system in the world. I've enjoyed my time on the Board of Game over the years. I feel I have a lot to offer, and I look forward to serving if I am reconfirmed to help manage and conserve Alaska game populations and continue working with the ACs, the department, general public, other stakeholders, and other Board of Game members to help manage game populations in Alaska. Thank you for your consideration.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Does the committee have any questions for Mr. Stanley Hoffman? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Mr. Hoffman, thanks for your service on the board. This is a question I try to ask of all appointees, especially someone like you who's been on the board for so long. With your perspective and long service, what issues do you see coming before the Board of Game that we should know about in advance? What do you anticipate your next term involving?
Yeah, through the chair. Currently, right now, we just currently dealt with bell sheep issues in certain areas of the state. Where we had to close it down to non-residents, which hasn't been done in a while. We also have, in the 1990s, the Malchatna caribou herd was about 200,000 animals, and we had a five bag limit, and now it's closed. You know, and that was just 20 years ago, so it went from 200,000 animals down to, you know, it's about 10,000 now. And there's other caribou herds that I think are in that could be end up in a similar situation if we don't try to take action, and that's, you know, the Western Arctic and yeah, mainly the Western Arctic. So just offhand, yeah, the Bell Sheep and the Caribou are ones that come to mind.
Okay.
Representative.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hoffman. I have a question from Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. Mr. Hoffman, I was wondering, what's your position on using electric bicycles for veterans who are disabled to go hunting?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Rauscher. We generally as a board look at a few of these every now and then for veterans, and where it works out, that makes sense to me. We like to provide that opportunity if it works out. We just did one in Kincaid and Anchorage and we approved it, but it's still pending due to the municipalities. It's in their ball court now, but yeah, if it meets all the requirements and thresholds and the game can withstand the resource can withstand the harvest. Generally, we pass those. The board passes those.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your answer.
Okay, let the record reflect that we've been joined by Representative Wright. Are there any further questions for Mr. Hoffman? Okay, I will now open public testimony for Mr. Hoffman's candidacy. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify on Mr. Hoffman's candidacy? Seeing none, do we have anyone online? All right, there is no one online to testify. So I will now close public testimony on the appointment of Mr. Hoffman. So, any other questions? All right, seeing none, let the record reflect that in accordance with AS 3905080, the House Resource Committee held a hearing on the appointment of Stanley Hoffman to the State Board of Game. Signing the committee report testifies to the members' participation in this hearing and does not reflect the intent of any member to vote for or against the confirmation during joint session. Mr. King will pass the committee report around as we move to the next item. Please let the record reflect that we have been joined by Representative Armstrong. Just go ahead. Okay, next on the agenda is a presentation by our organization, ADA. And we will hear an update from the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Agency. This presentation should give us more information about the state's efforts to improve infrastructure in support of mining, as we heard was critical in a previous meeting. There are four representatives from ADA joining us today. Brandon Brefczynski, Deputy Director, Jeff Johns, CIO, Jeff San Juan, Program Manager, Mark Davis, Special Counsel. So, Mr. Brefczynski, would you like to come forward and prepare to give your presentation? So, gentlemen, please state your names and your affiliations for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for inviting us here today. For the record, Brandon Brefczynski, Deputy Director of ADA.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jeffrey Johns. I'm the Chief Investment Officer of ADA.
And online, as you mentioned, we have Mark Davis, Special Counsel, and Jeff San Juan, the Ambler Program Manager. So just to kick things off, we wanted to provide just a brief overview of what is ADA and what does ADA do before we launch into some of our other programs that, while most folks may not think that they are connected to resource development, there is a correlation there, and then we'll get into some specific examples of resource projects under ADA. So ADA was created in 1967 with the mission to advance the state's economic growth as the state's the finance development authority. And one of our key components of the mission is that we're charged with creating more jobs for Alaskans. We want Alaskans to be employed and grow our economy through the development of infrastructure and financing of commercial activities. So we are financially self-sustaining. We do not receive funding from the legislature, aside from the initial loan portfolio that we acquired back in 1967 to get us going. We've received some grant funding in the past, but as far as our operating budget goes, these are all internal ADA funds. Then in 1997, ADA started to pay a dividend to the state, and since then we've paid about $450 million, an average of about $17 million a year to the general fund for the state to spend on various activities, operating capital budget. And overall, we've had our hands on about $3.5 billion of economic development. And Mr. Johns is just going to walk through, what are some of the criteria of the projects that we invest in.
Yes, please. Thank you. Again, addressing the question is what does ADA do? What is our mission? How do we fulfill that mission in terms of economic development and employment within the state of Alaska? As a public corporation of the state of Alaska and a political subdivision of DCCED, we have the ability to partner with the private sector to develop public-private partnerships, or more commonly referred to as 3P developments or P3 developments. We have the opportunity and take the mission perspective to work as a vetting agent for, again, economic development and business development and infrastructure development throughout the entire state. We finance projects that, again, fulfill our mission to emphasize, again, providing an economic impact to the state and employment and jobs for Alaskans, specifically and entirely focused within the state and employment for Alaskan residents. It's worthwhile to, as Mr. Brzezinski pointed out, is we do administer grants. However, we do not provide grant funding. Again, as we are self-sustaining and we sustain our revenue and balance sheet through the interest that we earn off of our various investments through our various programs. We finance that those investments through our ability to, again, provide debt financing. There are examples of various debt financing. One of our successful programs is called the Loan Participation Program, which we'll be getting to in a handful of slides here. We provide infrastructure loans, energy loans. Thank you. We have the ability to provide bonding, ADA direct bonds or conduit revenue bonds that are both taxable and tax exempt. We have the ability to form limited liability corporations. We can take ownership, equity ownership in various endeavors and projects. We can own facilities. And ultimately, we also non-financial related, but certainly help facilitate development or provision of loan guarantees. We can provide bond guarantees and we can provide letters of support. As an example, as more recently as within the last sort of 24 months, we provided a letter of support to the community of Haines for the development and receipt of a grant for their LUTAC dock. Very successful.
And as for the record, Brandon Brzezinski, and another letter of support for folks from Matsu here, we provided a couple letters of support for two federal grants that the Port McKenzie is seeking as well.
Okay, Mr. Johns, I have a question from Representative Brauscher.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, I was just wondering, back on, I guess, the previous page, where you were talking about $3.5 billion into the economic development in Alaska. So I'm trying to, is that from its insemination at 1997 till today? Is that the amount that's in play today? And if it's not the amount that's in play today, what is the amount that's in play today that you have your fingers on?
Well, this statistic is from inception, so approximately 56 years. But to get you a specific dollar amount in play right now in terms of direct financing and loans and bonding, we can follow up with specific details on the sort of the three legs of the stool that we provide, again, economic development within the state.
Which, through the chair, Representative Rauscher, and some of the slides further on in the presentation, we do have some specific, like, current information of our various programs and how much funding is out there. So might be able to answer your question in part.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Representative Sadler's question.
Thank you. Through the chair, following up to Mr. Brzezinski, I know that one of the big successes of the ADA model has been the DeLong Transportation Corridor and the Red Dog Mine Support. How much, back of the envelope, back of the hand, how much of that $3.5 billion is attributable to the Red Dog Mine?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I'm going to defer to Mr. Mark Davis to answer that, or we have a slide further on in the presentation that does cover DMTS in detail. We might be able to get to it there, but it's your choice.
I appreciate just getting some information, just even in back of the envelope.
Mr. Davis?
Can you hear us, Mr. Davis?
Yeah, I can. Can you hear me now? I keep getting muted. I apologize to the committee.
Did you hear the question, Mr. Davis?
Yes.
Okay.
So, Representative Stanley's in the chair. We'll have to actually calculate that out, but it's a substantial sum of money that we've collected over the years on the DMTS. It generates income for ADA, and 50% of that, of course, is paid back to the legislature in the form of a dividend. So in our recent dividends, it represents a significant portion of our dividend.
We'll wait to see the slide.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Davis. Gentlemen, please proceed.
Okay.
Yes, through the chair again. We are highlighting here on this particular slide what we refer to as our financing toolbox, or the various economic levers that we have in order to finance projects. As I spoke to previously, is we have a program called the Loan Participation Program, which we can take up to a certain amount of a loan from participating financial institutions to reduce debt service for those borrowers and ultimately allow banks to further leverage their balance sheet. And we will get into some details in a few slides here. As mentioned, we have a conduit revenue bond program. We are one of the state's principal issues of taxable and tax-exempt conduit revenue bonds. We have the ability to, again, direct project finance. A whole or in part, we can take, again, form LLCs. We can own and operate facilities. We will provide an example as the FedEx repair and maintenance facility at Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport that is now the third busiest cargo hub within the world that provides a significant driver to the Alaskan economy. We provide infrastructure development, and highlighted is the DeLong Mountain Transport System. And we are also, Mr. Brzezinski and Mr. San Juan, my colleague, will be speaking to infrastructure development activities that we are actively pursuing right now. And then lastly is through the Sustainable Energy and Transmission Supply Fund, as well as the Arctic Infrastructure Development Fund, we have the ability to develop Arctic infrastructure and sustainable energy projects that we have successfully funded and actively pursuing future development, for the benefit of all Alaskans. Getting into detail on some of our programs, as I highlighted, is one of our most successful programs is the Loan Participation Program. We have the ability to take up to 90% of a loan originated by one of our financial partners within the state. Our loans do not exceed $25 million. We can provide long-term patient capital in terms of tenor on the debt, 15 to 25 years, depending on the nature of the property and the loan. Some of our key metrics are a 75% loan-to-value. We have ability to offer fixed and variable interest rates, and those interest rates are publicly available and updated on a regular basis on the EDA website. And highlighting some of our most successful projects on the right-hand slide of the slide here is the Hunatotum development at Icy Strait Point, as well as the Extreme Fund Center in Wasilla. What we have not represented here is one of our more successful projects, as well as the financing of the Brooks Camp up in Dead Horse.
Okay, question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Johns. Just for the reference, so the 75% loan to value essentially means you'll loan up to 75% of the value, meaning the person trying to borrow has to have essentially 25% down
that,
payment.
That is correct, yes. Just from the chair. Thank you. Yes.
Well, I'm interested in the Wasilla Fund Center. That's a really great place. So maybe we could have a retreat there sometime. Okay, thank you, and please continue.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the second slide here, again, is just highlighting the range and throughout the state and our and the extent of our loan participation program. As you can see, is right now, there's in excess of approximately $390 million of loans out, currently outstanding, representing more than 250 discrete loans. We've been able to successfully grow our program over the last 5 years by approximately 30%, as you can see. And I think it's worthwhile highlighting that we do not have and have not had a delinquency rate right now currently on the program, which is quite successful. And you can see on the right-hand slide the geographic dispersion of our loan programs, obviously highlighted to the larger metropolitan centers in the state.
Through the chair, Brandon Brzezinski, for the next two slides, I'm going to ask that Mr. Davis present on our conduit bond program and provide some examples of that.
Okay, Mr. Davis,
I'm here. Mr. Davis, through the chair and members of the committee. Conduit bond and revenue bond are one and the same. Essentially, these are bonds that are issued by ADA, but they don't use ADA's assets. The bonds are repaid from the revenues generated by the project. So if the project has a revenue stream, we can issue bonds that don't impact ADA. They're not on ADA's books, nor are they bonds of the state of Alaska. They're not an obligation of the state. So what those allow us to do is issue fairly large bonds without any really risk to the state management that actually fund important projects. One of the original uses of the revenue bonds was the Dillon Mountain Transportation System, referenced by Representative Sadler. And then they've been used in Juneau, where you are now, for the Alaska Brewing Company. If you've seen their new improvements to their brewing facilities, those are all ADA revenue bonds. They've also been used in Western Alaska for the Waikiki Delta Clinic and Hospital, which allowed them to use a federal loan and bridge the gap which they had by revenue bonds, which was pretty creative for us. Also, in Interior Alaska, we have financed the Heart Center at Fairbanks Memorial Hospital. And in Anchorage, we provided for much of the financing for Provident Hospital's expansion. So revenue bonds can be large. We did one for the Tenenbaum Chiefs Conference in Fairbanks. It's in your slide number, I think, 8. And if you look at that, that's a good example. That's a large bond, $126 million. It's being paid back by the revenue generated by the new clinics. So by coming to us, TCC was able to open clinics in Tok, Evansville, Manly, Hot Springs, and Northway that otherwise would have been hard to finance because these are not areas that are traditionally financed by commercial banks, and also these are facilities that are somewhat difficult to construct. So ADA revenue bonds are able to look not at where the location of the project is, but the revenue stream from that project, and therefore build it, whether it's in Bethel or Tok or in Evansville. So it's a pretty powerful tool that we use. As I said, we've used it for brewing beer all the way to healthcare.
And through the chair, just to point out, too, the timing of for these healthcare facilities in 2019 was fortunate for the state, given that in 2020, as we all know, we're dealing with a global pandemic. So to have, you know, good healthcare facilities across rural Alaska, you know, was great there, but it's also good going forward, you know, and as we develop, you know, resources of our state, build out the infrastructure, communities will have the healthcare facilities they need in order to, you know, provide those services to hopefully employed Alaskans in the regions.
So. Okay, seeing no questions, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I touched on briefly, is one of our other financing tools that we have is direct project finance, where we facilitate development within Alaska's and broader speaking industrial sector. As I noted, we have the ability to form P3 type of relationships. We can take direct investment, again, as an equity owner a partner, a senior secured lender, highlighting the fact that ADA plays the role of long-term patient capital. Highlighting here is successful projects are the Hexquinlet Natural Gas Facility in Nikiski. We also have a successful loan with the Blood Bank of Alaska. As I briefly touched on, as one of our most successful projects, direct financing and owned assets, is the FedEx hangar at Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport. In the early 90s, we invested just over $32 million. We have a successful and strong relationship not only with the DOT and Ted Stevens, but obviously with our tenants, FedEx, such that we have applied for up to a 55-year land lease and associated lease with FedEx, and we will be investing up to $16 million more in the next 12 to 24 months in this particular facility, and further strengthening our relationship with Ted Stevens as well as FedEx.
So for the next slide, Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Mr. Davis to speak to these next two slides, and then Mr. Davis will be relieved.
Okay.
So again, this is Mark Davis for the record. I'm looking at slide 11, and that's called infrastructure development. And as Mr. John said, we are unique among economic development authorities in the United States that we are able to form an LLC or corporation with a private partner if need be, and to construct facilities in conjunction with their private capital, which we've done. Another indication of flexibility is the Camp Denali Readiness Center, which you've got a photograph of. What that was is the Coast Guard had lost its lease in Anchorage and was looking for new facilities in Alaska. Otherwise, it was going to move its personnel to Seattle, and we felt we should keep the Coast Guard in Alaska. To do that, we had to work with the Department of Military Affairs. They obtained a license from the Department of Defense to expand the armory at J-Bear. And then we built the facility for the Department of Military Affairs to their specifications. Then the Department of Military Affairs then leases that space to the Coast Guard, and then the Coast Guard pays DMV and they pay us. That sounds a little convoluted, but the reason it had to happen that way is that you have to have a military group, which is our Department of Military Affairs, have a license at a federal base, can't have a private developer. But secondly, the Coast Guard didn't have the money to build the facility. What it had was the money to rent the facility. So we built something they could rent, and we're actually making a slight profit. So we kept 104 people working for the Coast Guard in Alaska, and we're making money. That's kind of a typical ADA project. That's done through infrastructure development. The shipyard also has the photograph there. Again, we're working with a company called Vigor. We own that because that project has federal money in it and had to be owned by a state agency, so we're the pass-through for that. But actually, we work with the private industry, and a lot of what you see in there has been built by private industry. So again, it's a partnership between ADA in business to create jobs, and it creates a lot of jobs in the Ketchikan area. As I said before, we can use bonds, and we can also do what are called credit backstops or guarantees. So if a project isn't quite penciling out but looks like it can succeed, ADA can create a credit backstop through bonds or cash with a LLC, and by that process increase the creditability of that company that's building that project to borrow money from normal lenders such as investment banks or commercial banks, and then hopefully everything is paid off and we don't have to intervene, but we can use guarantees to make that more attractive. And finally, you know, when we need to, we can actually own things. An example of that is the city of Shandam, where you are in Juneau, that had to be owned by a state agency because of federal law. And so we own that facility, and then we lease it to the local Juneau Power Authority. And so again, we're fairly flexible.
And Mr. Chairman, before we move on to the next slide for Mr. Davis, we'll talk about DMTS. I just wanted to make note for the committee, I should have said this earlier, since we had an extension on our homework assignment to present before the committee, we went back and revised some slides and added things. So I apologize in advance that it didn't get to the committee in time, but it has since been provided to the committee aide. So.
All right, very well.
So, is Mr. Davis, again, for the record, I go just briefly through the Dolan Mountain Transportation System. Again, this is an ADA success story as Representative Sadler noted, and we appreciate that. It has generated substantial taxes, you can see from the slide, of $1.3 billion over its years. It has paid a PILT, which is a payment in lieu of tax, to the Northwest Arctic Borough of $269 million. And it's also provided what are called 7I payments. Those are payments that are sent to NANA Corporation and then redistributed as required under the ANSCA statute to other Native corporations throughout the state. And $1.6 billion has been shared between the 12 corporations just because of that effort. We've also created a lot of jobs in the region, and without ADA's involvement, this road and port probably wouldn't have been built. What happened was the developer, which is now Tech, had really needed additional cash to finish out the road and the port. It had the mine underway, and conventional financing will not cover this kind of large infrastructure. So they needed to reach out to an economic development authority, and we have that ability and used our revenue bond capability back in the day to get this built. And now it's providing lots of revenue for various people, lots of taxes, and lots of jobs. So it's the kind of project we would like to replicate, hopefully with the Amble Road and with some other projects we've got underway.
Okay, Mr. Davis, Representative Rauscher has a question.
Yeah, thank you. To the chair, Mr. Davis, I heard you say back in the day, our bond ability, has it changed much now?
Oh, Representative Rauscher, through the chair, what I meant was actually what we did there, it's kind of creative. We issued revenue bonds, and then we diffused those bonds and converted them into ADA bonds to get a better rate. So, and that's a little complicated, but we changed them from one kind of bond to another bond. The idea is for ADA to try to get our client the best rate on bonds so that the money goes into the project and doesn't go into interest.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, please proceed.
Okay. Again, for the record, Brandon Brzezinski. So now, Mr. Chairman, we're going to get into a few examples of the ongoing, the active ADA resource development projects. And see here, this is a picture of the Red Dog Mine with caribou in the foreground, as you can see. So Mr. Davis was just speaking to the transportation system, which allows for that mine to exist. So just to kind of give some background or context to this discussion, you know, like as the world is changing, as we're focusing more on low carbon or no emission types of technology, renewable technology, mining is critical in the development of these efforts. You know, and that's where like some of ADA's projects, such as like the Ambler Mining District, which has many of these critical minerals or essential minerals, will come into play. And this would also align with like the federal policy, which has placed an emphasis on critical mineral development in the Arctic. But to get to these minerals, to get to these resources, you need access. And that's always been Alaska's challenge. This is just to give some representation of how many miles of road the state has compared to other states, such as like Connecticut, which has 46,000 miles of road miles, according to the Federal Highway Transportation Department, US DOT, you know, 10,000 more miles than the state of Alaska. So
I wasn't aware that we had 36,000 miles. It didn't seem like it.
Right. So one of these projects the developer wrote, so in FY22, ADA received $8.5 million from the state in the capital budget. This is one of those examples of a grant that we administer on behalf of the state. We received that grant to do the permitting work for the West Susitna Access Project, which is approximately a 100-mile-long road starting in just southwest of Big Lake and going out to the – it terminates at the Whiskey Bravo Airstrip at the Upper Skwentna River, base of the Alaska Range. So this road, you know, as the capital project background suggested – we are moving forward with the permitting process only right now. Construction, financing of that, we're still working through to figuring out how that will look in the future. But as the permit process is going through with the Corps of Engineers, we are intending for this road to be a public access road and like a dual use, mixed use road. But the public will have access to this road to recreate, to get to other resources, to own land. Along the route of this road, there's about 73,000 acres of land within a 12-mile radius of the route. And of that, like 61% is owned by either the state or the Mat-Su Borough. You have in the Yetna Mining District, which is within this region here, there are like we're focusing on like more of like south of the road. And there's about 1,400 claims and mining claims encompassing about 220,000 acres. There's various gold and copper projects that are in exploration or have done some significant exploration work along this route. Actually, go to the next slide here. So the benefits of the project, like I was saying, there's mineral potential out there. There's potentially oil and gas opportunities. I know the DNR had issued a public notice for an exploration program within the region. Clearly, there's recreational activities along the route. In 2021 or 2020, Fish and Game opened up the Susitna personal use fishery. You know, that fishery, though, has received limited users, access obviously being one of the challenges to get to there, aside from others that we don't need to get into. But, for comparison's sake, like in 2021, that Susitna dipnet fishery saw about 200-ish days fished by Alaskans compared to like the Kenai, which saw 20,000 days fished for the year. And then for the forestry and agriculture potential, that goes back to just having access to the land. While the forestry, in terms of like an economic, industry of timber within that region, it may not be as viable as other locations around the state, but having that road would provide access for wildland fire, prevention, be able to get back in there to thin out the trees and do mitigation activities for the state, which, we've had some preliminary discussions, haven't been too engaged on the carbon credit program, but there could be some potential opportunities for like carbon credits through wildland fire mitigation activities. So now I'm going to ask to turn it over to Mr. Jeff San Juan, the Ambler Program Manager.
Okay, I need to say hi to Mr. San Juan, a friend of mine. How are you doing today, Mr. San Juan?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jeff San Juan, and I'll provide a quick update regarding the Ambler Access Project. And so the project is anticipated to be a P3, which is a public-private partnership, similar to the DMPS success story that Mr. Davis just represented and discussed, and Representative Sander as well. The current project is in the front-end engineering and design and feasibility phase, of which we currently have a funding agreement in place with Ambler Metals to fund 50% of the development cost. So the Ambler project is much further along than the West Susitna Access project that Mr. Brzezinski just talked about. Back in 2013, our AIDA got a funding of $17 million from the legislature to go through the permitting process. And we submitted federal permits to five federal agencies and received a record of decision in 2020. So that record of decision has been going through litigation, and the Bureau of Land Management has basically requested a remand of that record of decision, of which they're currently in the process of providing a supplemental EIS. So the Bureau of Land Management is currently undertaking a draft supplemental EIS, of which we're expecting to get a draft response by the end of this second quarter. So by June 30th is when we're anticipating getting a draft supplemental EIS. And then they've dictated to the courts that a final EIS and Record of Decision should be available by the end of this calendar year. And so we're in hopes of being able to have a successful remand on that, and then we can begin the litigation of our Record of Decision. And so next slide, please. So one of the things we did when we entered our submitted our applications to the federal agencies back in 2015, there was limited mine claims that were active when we filed the application. And this is a snapshot in time. You know, back in 2018 is where I actually pulled these data numbers from. But in 2018, we had over 1,368 mine claims. So when you look at that bottom left-hand corner, you can see that we had about 1,368 mine claims and about 110,000 acres of those were claims. And so the state of Alaska actually requires that any person who has an active mining claim, that you just can't sit on your mining claim. You actually have to invest a certain dollar amount when you hold a mining claim lease, actually a mining claim. And what you see here where it says required yearly labor for active mining claims, it shows back in 2018, the required annual revenue was about $275,000 that mining claim holder had to invest into those mining claims to further develop them. And in 2018, this is just a random date that we pulled, the actual project or mining claim holder at that time, which is Trilogy, had invested about $1.4 million. Okay? And we're going to, next slide please, on slide 20. So this is currently what the active mining claims are in the district, as well as on the eastern side. What you can see is there's been a significant improvement since the project has received a Record of Decision from the federal agencies. Just by receiving those federal Record of Decisions and permits on the federal land, we were able, you can see that there's over 3,700 active mining claims, and these are just the four large block holders of mining claims. There are probably significantly other smaller attributes, but this is what I pulled. The acres really quadrupled to about almost 500,000 acres of mining claims that are currently being explored and developed. When you take into consideration of what's the requirement for those mining claims to be developed and what the license holders have to invest in, it's about $1.3 million annually that those mining claim holders have to invest to maintain their active mining claim. So for 2020 and 2021, when I pulled the actual five reports from just South 32 and the Meadows, which are the current large block holders, they invested about over $14 million worth of labor and development of the mining claims that they currently hold. And so that's a significant investment outside of what Ada and Amber Meadows are doing regarding advancing our federal engineering and design phase. So that's just a key piece to showing that once you develop access projects and develop the most resources, as the slide earlier showed, Alaska is lacking in road infrastructure. If we had road infrastructure, we would be able to develop some of these claims. And it takes, and I believe this body is familiar, that it takes at least 10 to 15 years to explore and understand the mineral resources that are in these areas. And so I know South 32 is doing a lot of exploration to understand whether or not they have any kind of resource potential that they can fully develop. And so I want to go to the next slide. Thank you.
So
on the next slide,
Mr. San Juan, just briefly here, it looks like we're missing some of these slides in our pack. So I just want to ask if when you have a chance, if you could make sure the committee gets a full set.
Yes, sir.
And that way, that's why we're not seeing some of these. So any questions so far? Okay, please continue, Mr. San Juan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so this is one of the slides that we added because the Arctic mine is the most advanced exploration project in the mining district at this point. As you can see here, they have about 2.35 million indicated resources of copper and about 3.2 million pounds of zinc. You know, it took Arctic and a lot of the exploration companies probably over $80 million to get to a point where they felt comfortable enough to determine those resources. And when you look at bornite right now is just inferred at 6.5 million pounds of resources. So there's a lot of potential and a lot that you don't even understand because the investment is so expensive to invest because you have to fly everything in. So if and when we get to the develop a project, you know, it's going to be more economical to be able to explore many of the resources that you see in the prior slides regarding the active mining claims.
Okay, I have a couple questions, Representative Meters.
Thank you, through the chair. So it seems like this is pretty speculative at this point, and part of the need for investment is to be able to do, you know, on the ground research and exploration. At what point do we go from theory to reality? Do we determine that this is a good investment? And a second part to that is how do we gain that investment back again? How it seems like there's lots of different claims in here. How do we get our money back and our investment back from a project like this? Thank you.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Gutierrez, the first question, I would say that we're still in the feasibility phase. So we're trying to understand what the total cost of building up the road itself would be, right? So we're in the gathering data, scientific data. In fact, that's part of what our activities we're planning on for this year is trying to gather scientific data so we can understand where the fish passage streams are, where some of the cultural resource activities are. And so we're in the gathering the data, how much, or designing the road so that we can understand how much it will cost. And so we're still roughly at about a 20% design. And so we'll have a good idea of the cost, around 65%, of which we could be able to do some financial analysis and understand kind of, okay, well, how much does it take to be able to finance the project similar to DMTS? So that's what Mr. Davis was talking about earlier. We financed the project. The DMTS had a 50-year take-or-pay contract with Cominco at that time and said, hey, that was the source of revenue for the payment. And we anticipate something similar to the Amber Metal project where we have an agreement with Amber Metals to help pay for the road itself. And then I apologize for the second question. What was the second question, Representative Mears?
Thank you, through the chair. How do we get our money back? So I guess that you're starting to get into that.
Yeah. And so the second part is the rate of return would be similar to the DFTS, right? So we would enter into a long-term agreement with the mining company to pay us back on the toll.
Okay, thank you. Now we have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. San Juan, just to confirm that pretty familiar with gold and silver ounces and zinc and copper, we're talking billions of pounds. That's not ore. That's actually a pure element. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that is what I understand Trulia has reported on their, that's accurate, a website, a picture from their website. That is the actual ore concentrate.
Good. I'm sorry, ore concentrate?
The recoverable concentrate of copper, zinc, lead. It's the actual amount of resources that they're going to recover.
Through the Mr. Chairman, Representative Sather, we'll get back. We'll go through the because these are all citing the various financial reports that they have to submit. So we'll go back through those reports, which are quite lengthy. That's why we did not include them in here. But we'll pull out the snippets of information that you need and get back to you.
And a brief follow-up.
Okay.
Just define what indicated versus inferred is, please.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Sadler, when it comes to indicated, what that means is that the mining company has drilled sufficient holes short enough in distance that they feel very confident that resource potential is actually there. So in geology, a lot of these mineral resources are in belts. And so they're trying to they're doing geotechnical investigations, and they're doing core sampling. They're pulling that core sampling out. And in order for them to feel very confident that that resource exists, to move it from like an inferred over to a indicated, is that you have to conduct a significant amount of investment for you to have that confidence. And so this indicated report was done by a third party that basically looked at all of the core samples, and they feel very confident that the amount of copper is going to meet those thresholds. So it moves it to a more higher level of confidence.
Thank you.
Okay, I'd like to welcome Representative Stoops to House Resources. Welcome, Representative. All right. Please proceed, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This will be our final slide here, which may look slightly different from the prior version of the presentation, but content remains the same. We added this infographic here to provide some context of the scale of the ANWR leases, which I'm going to ask Mr. Jeffrey Johns to explain.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, this is Jeffrey Johns. Under ANILCA, the coastal plain, also known as the 1002 area, was specifically set aside for future oil and gas development. Per the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the first of two auctions was held in December of 2020, at which auction ADA successfully bid on 9 leases and entered into 7 lease agreements representing just under 370,000 acres. Per the detailed statement of sale, only a maximum of 2,000 acres can actually be used for surface infrastructure, which represents 0.001% of the total acreage representing ANWR. And ADA entered into these lease agreements by statute, specifically 4488-800, so we were legally entitled and lawfully entitled to do so. And we did so because we believe that this was very much in line and consistent with fulfilling ADA's mission of economic development and job creation within the state of Alaska. I'd also like to highlight that per House Joint Resolution number 12, that is identified that within Alaska there would be in excess of 7,000 direct and indirect jobs on an annual basis when the potential resources that the 1002 represents are developed and remain in development and production. And therefore, ADA is strongly of the position that we have valid leases. We're following, as the prudent owner and operator, the lease stipulations as well as the required operating procedures, and most recently, per the approved budget for activities this year, we will be ongoing necessary activities to follow those particular stipulations and procedures, and commencing a community outreach program related to preparation and hopefully submission of permitting. Sorry, Mr. Chairman, I will hold my comments.
Okay, this is very interesting. Could you, I don't know if it's a little bit off the subject, but have they ever released the information from the infamous Chevron KIC well that was drilled way back in the, I believe it was the early 80s? Is that well still confidential?
Through the chair.
In ANWR?
Mr. Chair, I think you're going to have to ask Mr. Huber at AOGCC for that.
I believe it's still.
Which it's still confidential.
Confidential. Yes. Just checking. All right. Any questions from the committee? Representative Armstrong, mining, no questions? Okay.
Through the chair, you know I'm always excited to learn more about opportunities there.
Okay. Just want to make sure you get equal time. All right. Well, seeing no other questions then, gentlemen, thank you for your presentation. Great to see you here today. Mr. San Juan, great to see you. And we'll let you go then for the day. Thanks for being here. And please follow up on our questions and,
yes,
and slide updates.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Whoops. Okay, the next item on our agenda today is House Bill 20. So now we will have an introduction of House Bill 20. which is related to conflicts of interest on the boards of fish and game. This is our first hearing on this bill. My intent is to hear an introduction today, then set the bill aside. So, Representative Stutz and your staff, would you please join us at the presenter's table?
Happy to do so, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I really appreciate it. Nice to see you all. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the Resource Committee. For the record, my name is Representative Louise Stutz, representing District 5, Kodiak, Cordova, Seward, and many smaller coastal communities. House Bill 20 will be new to some and not to others. It's a bill that will help the boards of fish and game to move more thoroughly and examine issues before them with the available knowledge of their respective members who serve on that board. Currently, the boards of fish and game are precluded in statute from deliberating on matters which a member has declared an interest, either for themselves or an immediate family member. The boards were established by the first legislature to have responsibility and authority for establishing regulations and allocating the fish and game resources of the state among various user groups. We expect that the board members are selected precisely because they have a knowledge and ability in the field of action that they are being endeavored to oversee. And we want to encourage a diverse interest and points of interest on this board. As it stands, these same members are precluded from deliberating on these matters. So if they have a conflict, they cannot share the information that they may have an area of expertise in. Not only can they not share it, but, Mr. Chairman, they must remove themselves from the dais or from the table and go and sit in the audience. House Bill 20 will establish that these members will be allowed to deliberate but not vote on subjects before the board for which they have declared an interest. The fact of the matter is, Mr. Chairman, that these conversations are happening regardless. They are just happening behind closed doors and allowing the members of these committees to participate in the conversation will make it a much more transparent situation for not only for the board but for the public. So with that, I would like to thank you, and I am going to pass the baton over to my staff, Ms. Donna Page, who will take you a little further into this bill.
Okay, Ms. Page, please put yourself on the record and
begin. Yes, sir. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the House Resources Committee. For the record, Donna Fox Page, staff to Representative Louise Stutz. Mr. Chairman, House Bill 20, an act relating to participation in matters before the Board of Fisheries and the Board of Game by members of the respective boards and providing for an effective date, would improve the function of the Board of Fisheries and the Board of Game by allowing members to deliberate on subjects for which they have declared a personal or financial interest according to AS 3952, the Executive Branch Ethics Act. Currently, board members are required to divulge a conflict of interest if they or an immediate family member are involved in the subject upon which the board is set to deliberate. Specifically, AS 3952-120C specifically calls out Board of Fish and Board of Game to disclose personal or financial interests in a business or organization related to fish or game resources in the matter set out by AS 3952-220. So it's specifically Board of Fish and Board of Game that have this requirement. Members of the Board of Fisheries and the Board of Game are selected in part due to their knowledge and ability in the field of action of the board and with a view to providing diversity of interests and points of view in membership. House Bill 20 establishes that conflicted members can lend their expertise to the discussion but cannot vote on the issue. This allows them to deliberate on the proposal before the board before recusing themselves from the vote. It makes no changes to anyone's ability to vote nor to how a conflict of interest is established. House Bill 20 would allow board members to share the knowledge they gain by participating in determined fisheries or hunting activities. This aids in decision-making for sound resource management. These boards are tasked with allocating some of Alaska's most precious resources. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to answer questions or review the sectional analysis.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add one thing that I think was, I really want to make very clear to this committee, nothing else changes other than it allows board members to participate in the discussion. None of the parameters that are determined whether or not you have a conflict or being changed. Nothing other than the fact that you're allowed to participate in the discussion and not vote on the issue. Thank you for that, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, what I'd like to recommend is Ms. Page go ahead with the sectional and we can get that crossed off the list and then we can have a good debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 1 amends AS 3952220B to allow a board of game or board of fisheries members to take official action defined by Section 3 of the bill as deliberating but not voting on a matter that they have a personal or financial interest in. Section 2 amends AS 3952220A to exempt Board of Fisheries and Board of Game members from the provision of the Executive Branch Ethics Act that prohibits them from deliberating on matters they have a personal or financial interest in. Section 3 amends AS 3952-220 by adding a new section that allows Board of Fish and Board of Game members with a personal or financial interest in a matter to deliberate but not vote on that proposal or subject being considered by the board. And finally, Section 4 establishes an immediate effective date.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Page. So I believe Representative Sadler had his hand up.
Thank you. Yes, sir. I do. Through the chair, Representative Stutes, you said in your comments that some of the effect of these conversations are taking place anyway. And in hearing the sectional analysis, it sounds like Section 2 is designed to remove that prohibition. I guess my question is, are you saying that members of boards of fish and or game are currently violating 3952-220 and are, in fact, deliberating matters in which they have a personal or financial interest?
I am saying that these discussions are taking place behind closed doors, out of the view of the public and off the record.
And therefore in violation of the law?
Yes, sir.
That strikes me as a fairly serious situation. So, Representative Stutes, does this happen quite often? It's not a topic I'm personally familiar with. And like we do in the legislature quite often, it seems like members declare a conflict of interest and then we just waive that and demand that they vote anyway. So, two questions there for you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stutes, through the chair, these conversations are not taking place on the record, as I stated. They are, when you have been conflicted out, I have seen many times where they have taken an at-ease, or I have actually heard conversations going on off the record with the conflicted member sharing their information, which is why this bill came about. It should be done in a transparent, on the record manner. And I think another thing that's really important to note is this affects every sector. It doesn't affect one sector of, say, fisheries any differently than it would any other sector. It's a flat across the board, fair application of this.
So getting back to my question, does this happen fairly often? Or,
yes, sir, it does.
It does.
Fairly regularly.
I don't know how to define that, but that's good enough. And so if a board member discloses their conflict, have we seen the board vote to allow them to participate anyway, or does that not happen?
I have not seen that, but it doesn't mean it hasn't happened. in the past, but when they declare their conflict, the usual procedure is they are then required to get up and leave their seat from the board position and go out and sit in the audience.
Representative McCabe has a question.
Thank you, and I suspect I know this answer, but through the chair, Representative Stutes, these boards are covered under the Open Meetings Act?
Yes, they are.
Follow up?
Yeah, please, Representative McCabe.
Thank you. Through the chair, so I know from talking to you that there's a difference between the way the Board of Game and the Board of Fish handle these conflicts. Maybe could you delve into that a little bit?
It's the same statute that covers them. It just seems to be that the Board of Game doesn't end up with near the conflict that the Board of Fish does. I think Ms. Page can actually give you some numbers on the number of times, and we have an invited witness that who personally has been conflicted out numerous times.
Okay, Ms. Page, can you answer that question?
Yes, through the chair, Representative McCabe, we do know that since 2005 in the Board of Fisheries alone, the percentage of recusals is up to 24%. That fluctuates year on year, but some of those numbers are between 18 and 24% of people that have had to exclude themselves from the vote.
Okay, and you mentioned, Representative Stutes, you had an individual that would like to testify.
I believe.
Are they in the room or online?
They're online. Are they online? John Jensen, I believe, is online. No? He's
online. Do we have anybody online?
Nate Rose.
Nate Rose?
He's a fisherman out of Kodiak. Yes, Mr. Okay. Chair.
Would you like to have him?
I would.
All right. We will allow Mr. Nate Rose to testify if you can get him on the line. Okay.
Good afternoon.
Mr. Rose, can you hear me all right?
Yes, sir. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
You might speak up a bit. You're a little bit soft.
How about now?
Can you get them turned up a little bit, Zach? Okay, try it again, Mr. Rose.
How about now?
Okay, I guess we'll make sure we're good and quiet so we can hear you. So why don't we give you 3 minutes, Mr. Rose, please.
Sure, I'll try to speak as loud
and,
as I
please
can.
State your name and your affiliation for the record, please.
Okay, my name is Nathaniel Rose, Nate Rose for short. I'm with Kodiak Caners Association based out of Kodiak. I'm a salmon caner, caner crab fisherman, pot cod fisherman here as well. Ultimately, the interest in this conflict of interest bill is it affects us heavily because if you simply take a look at the pool of potential board members, especially from different representative areas, coastal Alaskan communities or rural communities, I think the legislature and the governor himself find themselves always searching for quality candidates, and when quality candidates take a look under the current situation of Board of Fish members having to be recused themselves, we find ourselves asking what's the point of being on the Board of Fish if you can't even speak about the issues that are most concerning to your area or to your fishery. And in regards to Representative Stutes' claims about conversations happening in back rooms, ultimately that is the reason why you or the governor chooses candidates and you guys confirm them is so that they can share the vast expertise that they have and the knowledge they have, the management plans and the management areas that they know. And when they go through a recusal process, then that vast knowledge and that wisdom is lost. It never gets shared and it never gets deliberated upon. And so ultimately this conflict of interest bill, more than anything, just allows, it allows kind of an in-depth look from a very important viewpoint for a lot of these complex issues.
Okay. Are you finished, Mr. Rose?
Yeah, I think that's all I have to say on that. I believe the bill would be a good thing as far as allowing transparency in a conversation happening at different management areas. So, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for your testimony. So how is a conflict of interest determined to exist? Is it a commercial?
It's financial.
Financial?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Related to the fisheries.
Okay. I'm concerned here because there's been some kind of serious statements made about, frankly, lawbreaking and legal issues with regards to recusals and open meetings regulations. So it seems to me Representative Stutz, did legislative legal advise you on those problems, or do we need to, it seems like maybe we need to take a deeper dive into all of our open meetings and recusal regulations.
Well,
for all our boards.
No, through the chair, Representative Stu speaking. No, I haven't spoken to Ledge Legal about it because most of these conversations are conversations that, you know, three or four of the board members are going to lunch, and one of them is the recused individual. That's where these conversations are taking place. I think the biggest issue that I'm trying to address is having those conversations take place from off the record back onto the record to have much more transparency and clarity on the issues.
Okay, Representative Rauscher, questions?
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. Through the chair, I was wondering, Representative, why doesn't it exist now? What's the reason behind it?
I wish I could tell you that, Representative Rauscher. This bill has been around for a while Representative Stutz speaking. At one point, there was some concern that maybe one sector of fisheries would benefit over another, but that simply is not the case. This bill treats all sectors equally. It doesn't matter if it's personal use, if it's commercial, if it's sport. If you have been conflicted out, you will be able to participate in the conversation. And previously, there was some idea, as I said, that maybe one sector would benefit to a greater degree than another. And that just is not the case.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Sadler, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not maybe a question, but more a comment. Having worked in boards and commissions, boards have varied membership for the possibility to make sure and get different perspectives to bring to bear on the issue at hand, and also possibly to offer the opportunity for a person who has a direct interest to exempt themselves from the participation in that debate. And I would note that the concern legally is not so much the Open Meetings Act, but the Executive Branch Ethics Act, which is 3952. Which that says in part that a member of a board cannot take action that will benefit themselves personally. And I think that's the genesis of the concern, why members of the boards and commissions, which are executive creatures, cannot take action, cannot vote on something that might feather their own nest or, line their own pocket. And I think I hear the argument, but it's up for us to, as a policy call, to decide whether we should encourage people to talk about an issue in which they may have a personal interest. I would take some comfort knowing they can't vote, but still there is the ability to influence policy by participating in the debate, persuading other people to support your point of view, even if the member did not get the final vote on that issue. So I do see the issues in here.
In regard to that, it's interesting to note that the Board of Fish and the Board of Game are the only two boards of all the boards in the state that are have to live by that particular statute. Mm-hmm.
Okay, Representative Sadler. And that was Representative Stutz that just said that. Oh, Representative Sadler.
All right. I would note probably that with my experience, there are a few boards in which the issues and passions and dedication are as high and strong and fervent as there are for the Board of Fish and Board of Game.
Definitely.
Okay, did you want to have, we still haven't seen Mr. John Jensen.
I don't see him with
you. So what I wanted to do, Representative Stutes, was just make sure I mentioned that. And,
thank you.
And perhaps ask him to submit written testimony if you would like to.
Thank you kindly. I will do that. And, Representative Stutes speaking.
I'm not a lawyer, and I guess I don't try to play one on TV, so but it seems to me that maybe there's a legal question here about that maybe the Department of Law would comment on some of the statements that were made today about the Open Meetings Act and the recusals and so forth under the statute. So are there any other questions from the committee? All right. Well, thank you for your participation today, Representative Stutes and Ms. Page.
Thank you.
We will hold HB 20 in committee. And so thank you for being here.
Thank you for hearing the bill.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm. And now we will go to any other business. And one thing in particular, I wanted to wish Representative Muir's father a happy birthday, in case he might be watching us today. Never know. You're welcome. So I see no other business. So the next committee meeting will be held at 1 o'clock on Wednesday, May 3rd, and we will be hearing from Alex Epstein about the fossil fuel future. I know we've been hearing an awful lot about renewables and windmills and solar panels and so on and so forth, and Mr. Epstein gives a very interesting presentation on the future of fossil fuels. So I encourage all of you to be here and watch Mr. Epstein's presentation. Mr. Sadler.
Mr. Chairman, I'm familiar with a Lois Epstein, a female who has a significant interest in those issues. I don't know if that might be Lois Epstein going to be speaking. If not, my mistake.
I believe it's Alex.
My mistake, then. Thank you.
In fact, I'm quite sure it's Alex Epstein. All right, with nothing else before the committee, thank you, and we are adjourned at 2:19 p.m.